Anyway, so it seemed like it would be a good time to discuss broadly the themes of the program, where people thought we should be going, where perhaps people think we shouldn't be going, and basically think about fruitful avenues for future progress. So I've just listed over here some of the big themes of the program. Of course, there are others, I guess, you could add entanglement. It's the other program. This week, of course, is our Black Hole Information Focus Week, so we could start with thoughts on that, but more broadly, people could make comments on the other things. When we get to the question of decoding the hologram, let me just mention, clearly that is one of the big themes in the subject, and many people assume that the ADS-CFT fine-grained equivalence is the answer. But if that is the answer, there's a question of how we use that answer. And that's really a test of whether it is the answer, in my opinion. So here's at least one attempt to formulate a challenge along those lines, which one could refine. So I don't think we have anything else in particular to say, unless you do, Ted. We could, I think,
no.
We could open it up to comments, thoughts, questions, statements of protest, whatever. So,
I guess I have a question. It's sort of, well, one of the sort of things I've learned and heard a lot about in this program is the whole idea of code subspaces, error correction, that there's a whole bunch of states out there in the field theory which are not really relevant for a lot of the supergravity analysis involved. And so then I was just wondering, in Ted's talk yesterday, he also had sort of a new proposal, I thought, for how everything could be consistent without firewalls, and that maybe the radiation that we see in the bulk is not in a pure state, but the whole thing is because of something else. And so I was just wondering, could the something else be this sort of stuff that's outside the code subspace? And I don't think you listed that as one of your options at the end for where the information is hiding, but it occurred to me that that might be a possibility.
Certainly. Well, it's a code subspace, not a code tensor fact, right? We normally think of information as being in a subsystem, which is a factor of the Hilbert space. The code is supposed to be the code subspace would mean the Hilbert space is a direct sum of stuff that's in the code and stuff that isn't in the code.
So subspace is literally some submanifold in the Hilbert space or something?
It's not a vector.
It's a vector space. It's closed under addition.
It is a vector space.
Yeah. Subspace means subspace.
Yeah. Well, okay. So what's the problem if it's a subspace?
It's not a tensor factor. It's a direct. It's a piece of a direct sum.
But
those aren't the same thing.
But the quantum field theory Hilbert space.
What?
The quantum field theory Hilbert space, I would say, is a tensor factor.
Yeah, but not right. But not in, well, up to these gauge issues, but yes.
So that means that, that actually quantum field theory Hilbert space contains very little of information.
Well, very little. Sorry, what do you mean by that?
You mean, but when you say the quantum field theory
Hilbert space. Well, maybe they're in an entangled state, so you can't really distinguish where they sit.
I mean, I should clarify that I've never argued that there are CFT states that don't have bulk interpretations. I think all CFT states should have bulk interpretations. So that's not the way that the quantum error correction proposal works.
But some of them are not low energy, or some of them.
Yeah, so some of them have black holes. That's still a bulk interpretation. It's just that, a typical high energy state is some huge black hole, but I mean that's still some. I mean I still know what it is.
But you cannot distinguish the two, by bulk, usual low energy bulk.
That's correct. Yeah. And so, maybe it's worth emphasizing that although we often say the code subspace, we really mean a code subspace. So there's no unique code subspace. You can pick whichever one you want, and then you can ask on that subspace, to what extent is there bulk effective field theory? And so for example, and how good is the code for whichever subspace we pick, and it can be better or worse depending on which one you pick. And so, for example, if you can consider the subspace of states where, there's a huge black hole of radius 100 AES radii sitting in the center, you can just consider the set of all states you get like that. There's still quantum error correction working outside the black hole, explaining the fact that operators that are outside have different representations on the boundary at the same time, and so you can then keep making the black hole bigger, and the code sort of gets worse and worse because the protected information is just getting closer and closer to the boundary, and so it's getting hard. You can erase it by smaller and smaller errors, and at some point you're just back to the whole CFD Hilbert space.
But how do you think about the states of the black hole in that language?
Well, they're there. I mean, so for example, if you want something concrete in these tensor network models, you can just remove some tensors. So you have this linear map. So in the version where there's not a black hole, you have the subspace of perturbative excitations in the bulk, which is gotten by this pentagon network with the dangling leg off of each tensor. And that's some small subspace of the Hilbert space, which, if you like, is the no black hole subspace of the Hilbert space. And now if you want to start making black holes, what you can do is you can start removing tensors. And each time I remove a tensor, I'm replacing one input leg with five input legs. So the Hilbert space is getting bigger. Eventually I remove all of them, and then I've got just back the CFD Hilbert space again, so I've accounted for everything. But and you can see that, when I remove them, right, I get an object whose entropy is going like the area.
And I defend it.
But the black holes can't be all of those, because some of those would.
That's correct. So you direct subtract the part where you just put the tensor back in.
But still underlying this, there's a equality, so to speak, a one-to-one map between the Hilbert spaces.
That's correct. That was the point I wanted to make. So in this way, I can account for all states in the CFD with the bulk picture.
Yeah, but if I understand correctly, I mean, I've always subscribed to this sort of strict ADS CFT where, yes, the Hilbert space is the greedy and the bulk in the boundary, so there is a one-to-one map between them. But it's not true that every state of quantum gravity in the bulk has a nice sort of semi-classical space-time.
Yeah, that's right. So the way I like to think about that is that it has to do with the observables. So we can define gauge invariant bulk observables, but they don't have to make sense in all the states.
What do you mean they don't have to make sense in all the
states? Well, they don't have to make sense in all the states. For example, if you have to make them gauge invariant, you have to dress them. So there's some long story about this, but.
You could have some Planck soup, for example.
Well, yeah, but roughly, for example, say I have an operator which is arranged so that near the vacuum, it's just sitting in the center of the bulk. And now I consider a state where there's a black hole there, which is 10 to the 500 AES radii in diameter. So there are a lot of states like that, a lot more than there are near the vacuum. But I don't really expect this operator to make any sense in those states. I mean, even someone who falls into the horizon isn't going to be able to see this operator.
The operator doesn't act on the whole Hilbert space. It only acts on a certain
space. Well, you can extend it to the whole Hilbert space, but in some arbitrary way. You're only interested in how it acts on the subspace of states where it's sort of accessible to some bulk observer and it's not far behind some horizon. So
the statement is it only acts like the bulk semi-classical notion you thought you were modeling in a limited class of states.
That's correct. Yeah. And so basically the bigger you take your code subspace, the fewer observables there are that work on all of the states.
They work as you would have expected.
They work as you would have expected on all of the states.
I mean, maybe just a different way to say that, but I would like to think of this because there is a one-to-one mapping between the states in the Hilbert space, so it's not like that operator cannot be, like I cannot talk about acting that operator in the vacuum, acting to a very highly excited state.
Yes, but you shouldn't presume to know what its properties are. So for example, the thing that we explained is that one thing naively, some people might have thought that operator that you define in the center should somehow commute with operators near the boundary and as an operator equation in the Hilbert space. But that can't be true. And so we proved it can't be true, or maybe proved is a strong word. We argued, I think, convincingly that it can't be true. But I think the important point is that it doesn't need to be true, right? That in these states where it's, you know, far behind the horizon, and it's too much to ask for it to still commute with all the local operators.
Well, it's too much to ask for that even in states where it's not behind the horizon. Because if you have a given definition of how to throw a geodesic down toward the center,
that's right.
There could be a bulk semi-classical geometry, right, where the geometry is so highly curved that your bulk geodesic actually bends in some way, and it's close to a boundary, and is in fact causally related to part of the boundary that you thought it was going to be space-like.
That's correct. Yeah. So even right, that's a more sort of subtle but correct way in which you can think about this. Yeah.
So I love the summary you're giving of your work right now, but the other day in Ted's talk, you seemed to make a point that what you were saying was that you needed some kind of error correcting code that couldn't just be the imposition of the bulk, you know, gravitational constraints. And if the two Hilbert spaces are equal, I don't know what you mean by that statement.
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by the bulk gravitational constraints. So here's something which I claim is a fact, although I guess we just quoted it in the paper rather than giving a calculation.
Yeah.
But if you define operators in the bulk by geodesics on the boundary, then to all orders in perturbation theory, they commute with all local operators on the boundary on a boundary Cauchy surface, except for the one where the geodesic ends.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so that's some non-trivial fact. It's not as easy to prove as it is in market dynamics. It's some annoying calculation. So that's what the constraints would tell you. That's some non-locality, but it's not enough non-locality. So I claim that in the CFT, you can't have the operator that represents this operator in the bulk can't actually commute with all the operators in a time slice except for at one point.
And your last comment is true. You claim that it can't do that even at infinite end if you require it to happen to all orders in the one-degree expansion.
In all states. So the one of random expansion is very subtle if we try and use it in all states.
One of random expansion is subtle if you try to use it in all states.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I mean. I mean as an operator equation, not evaluate. So a one of random expansion in an operator equation really means small in the operator norm, which is a very strong statement.
We can talk about this in more detail another time, but as you said, you have a set of states where it commutes exactly.
Yeah.
And the extension beyond that set of states is arbitrary. So if I take the extension to be zero in the orthogonal complement of the coded subspace, it seems I get exact commutivity.
No, I think you can't. You can't.
You can't.
No, you can't. You can prove in quantum field theory that you can't have this.
Yeah. So what goes wrong with this?
Well, maybe I have to draw a picture. I mean, if we want the whole talk about this, there's a grown-up version of the time slice axiom because you have to deal with this point. So roughly what you argue is you use the time slice axiom plus Hogg duality to argue that if you have an operator that on a potentially non-local operator that commutes with all local operators except at one site on a time slice in one location, then it's actually a local operator at that site. Okay, but that's inconsistent with bulk causality because you know that there are points on the other side of the thing where it can't commute with them.
I always get confused.
That are space like separated in the CFT.
I always get confused in this discussion about whether this discussion is being held at finite end, or whether this is really a discussion at in the infinite end limit in a one over n expansion.
No, I want to be as large as finite end.
But then it's a different story.
But then I work
in finite end. We agreed that from the bulk point of view, there's no reason to expect this commutivity. The commutivity only happens.
No, but
at
you expect it to be
end.
Small. You expect it's a well-known fact that at finite end, perturbation theory is a good approximation.
It's a question of what small means.
So minus n squared.
But in all states or in
no, not in all states. So no, the whole point is not in all states. But that's not a statement about the constraints. That's my point. This restriction on the states is not something that comes from the constraints of general relativity. It's an additional restriction that you put in.
No, we just agreed that there are states of semi-classical general relativity where the commutator will be large. There are states where the metric is such that if you try to run in a space like geodesic, it won't end up in the center.
Yeah.
You aim it in some way, it'll come around close to the boundary.
You changed what you mean by semi-classical general relativity.
I haven't.
Yeah, I think you have, because first we were talking about the one over n expansion of large n Yang Mills theory, which corresponds to perturbative diagrams around the ES space, asking us to talk about semi-classical deformations of the method that are large. That's something that goes outside the one over n expansion.
Well, there are various points depending on what you do with sources, of course.
Yeah.
For the theory, and I'm trying to track what I thought Dan was doing. If we stick to things that are perturbatively close to ADS or states that are near the vacuum, then we lie in Dan's code subspace, and there's no issue with this commutativity.
So I mean, to some extent, you could say that I'm making a straw man because you know the argument. I mean, it's just intended to highlight the fact. I mean, you can, of course, just say, well, I knew all along from the bulk point of view that I only wanted to talk about a subspace.
Yeah.
But the idea is to give you a different way of thinking about that that's more rigorous.
And the language is lovely, and I like the realization, but I was trying to understand when there was a sharp cut statement that really there is, that this is
so
not...
I can't interpret
what you're saying as a way of thinking about imposing the bulk constraints. So it's really more physics.
Well, so the sharp statement is, if you take... to all orders in perturbation theory, the consequences of the around the vacuum.
Yes.
As you take those algebra, and then you just declare that should be true as at the level of the operator algebra and the CFT, you get a
large
contradiction. Yeah, at large but finite n.
Right.
And it's a contradiction even if you say, oh, this algebra holds up to non-perturbative and small corrections. That won't save you from the contradiction. At the level of the operators, the violations need to be order one.
Order one in...
in some states.
Okay.
That's what I mean by an operator equation. It means I find some state where it's one. But we also know,
just from gauge theory, that there are many states of the gauge theory in which the 1 over n expansion, as usually formulated, just fails.
Yes, that's right.
Because you've excited n squared degrees of freedom and so on.
That's right, but there were people who thought that even in states like that, these commutators should still be small.
Right.
So bringing this back to other themes, can we? Does it help us with black hole information, say, with the one, perhaps along the lines Ted suggested or otherwise?
Gives a nice model.
It would be a great resolution. I think that would be terrific. We get nice smooth horizons. We get unitary.
One of the challenges.
He said you can't reproduce semi-classical physics inside the horizon. That's not a smooth horizon.
To be clear, I said far behind the horizon. So the
details are not clear because it's coarse grained at the ADS scale.
Yes, good. Right. So that's all. And to describe the smooth horizon, all you need is an ADS scale because you only last for an ADS time.
Yep.
So it's clear. I think it's clear that you can't describe things that are way inside the horizon on the nice slice. Okay, I think that we probably is rigorously established. I mean,
You mean it's certainly not there in your model. I'm not sure there's a theorem.
I think it is because then you would say that if you thought that you could go arbitrarily far in on the nice slice. Then you would say that by shooting these long geodesics, I can make something that commutes with everything on the boundary except a point, even in these highly excited states. And that's not allowed in the CFT.
But can you describe the physics of an infalling observer up to the point that he gets close to?
Well, that's a harder question. But let's first decide about this crude question.
No, if the black hole is, I mean, depends what you're doing. If the black hole is formed by collapse, then everything inside it is in causal contact with the boundary. It's all in the future of the boundary.
But that's not the way, I have to draw a picture. I mean, that's not the way we think about it, right? We're talking a fixed time, so you want to, right, like here's the shell that goes in, although in principle, to talk about generic states, we should also be allowed to build it up slowly, but.
Yeah.
And now we're looking at the Hilbert space way up here.
Yeah.
Okay? And now the question is, it's true that by shooting a space like geodesic from the boundary here, if I shoot it for long enough, I can get all the way over here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Isn't that what Lenny was talking about, for example?
For example.
Well,
That wasn't a Jew either.
It
doesn't.
So
there is an operator.
It doesn't have to be a Jew.
So then I think to Allerger's interpretation theory, this operator has the property that it commutes with everything at the boundary except at the endpoint of the geodesic. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Now, yes, I agree.
So now that kind of suggests that this operator should have that property in any state.
But that would be impossible just by unitarity in the CFT. We don't need to invoke error-correcting code models to see that it's not possible. Right? The operator is in causal contact in the future of the CFT, so there's something that doesn't...
The evolution back to here is some big mess, right? I'd rather not try and do bulk evolution. I mean, the point is I can make this argument without doing bulk evolution. I just look at the Hilbert space with fixed time.
Okay.
And I say that you can't... I mean, of course, anything that's true, probably there's more than one way of arguing that it's true. But one way of arguing that it's true is that I can't have an operator with this property in CFT. But I don't find so. What I claimed was a rigorous.
What's the difference from the error correcting properties in the outside case? I mean, it looks like commuting with everything, but actually it's not. Because
there the excuse was there's a whole bunch of states where actually it doesn't commute. Okay?
Including things like this.
Yeah, and so usually what I would say is that set of states where it doesn't have to commute includes this one. If I don't say that, I don't think the proposal would work. Yeah.
So then you said that it's a long calculation. So to what extent does it work the properties of AGS Schwarzschild?
The calculation I actually did was just in the vacuum, but I think it should. I think from the point of view of the path integral, it kind of makes sense that it's more general. I think Will and Steve were also thinking about this. The calculation I actually did was you work in Pfefferman-Gram gauge and Poincaré slicing of ABS. This is just to make it easy. And then you look at the commutator of this guy and that guy, and then you ask whether or not it's local in the x direction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's a using exercise in direct brackets. And it's not obvious that it's going to be local in the x direction because to compare, right? So in electromagnetism, the analog would be Pfefferman, like axial gauge. Okay? And then here the commutator of the constraints doesn't involve any x derivatives, right? Because this is just a Laplacian. So then it's going to be local automatically. Its inverse will be local automatically in the x direction, so the Dirac brackets will be local in the x direction. That argument is false in gravity, so you need a better argument to argue that these signs.
Yeah, what happens to the derivations from? I mean, we have a evolving geometry. What happens then?
So what I showed was to all orders in, so I showed to all orders in perturbation theory in general relativity, including higher derivative operators, that these can be.
So there's an ancient argument, and maybe Tom can tell me the extent to which it's a theorem or just a hand-waving argument, that if you use a covariant gauge, then to all orders in perturbation theory around any background, you'll find, microcausality in that covariant gauge, basically because you can't change the light cones perturbatively.
No, you could easily do something like, for example, if I did Coulomb gauge.
No, I said in a covariant gauge. My point is that you're using a gauge invariant operator that I could express in terms of covariant gauge things.
Yeah, but it would be non-local in the covariant
gauge. But he's only doing equal time commutators, and it's non-local along the line he's drawn.
So that tells you where the non-locality is now. It's space-like separation. I don't want it to just be exactly equal time.
Yeah.
It's space-like separation and equal time is not the same thing at all.
I'm sorry, I withdraw that comment, but the point is, it's non-local along a particular line he's drawn, that in perturbation theory lives at a certain place in the background.
No, if you let the thing evolve with the Heisenberg equations of motion to all other points that are space-like separated, you get non-locality all over the place.
Yeah, this non-locality will spread.
It spreads causally, though, if you have a causal gauge, if you have a covariant gauge.
From the
causally
line.
From the point and the line.
Causally from the point and the line.
Right, which is what we want.
Now, the other thing that's true in all covariant gauges is the Hilbert space is not a Hilbert space. It's a space with negative metric. Always has to be.
This is also true.
And that the commutator algebras are different in that Hilbert space and in the space of gauge invariant states which in GR doesn't include anything local, so...
But it's just a restriction, right? If I get zero in the bigger space, I must get zero in the space of gauging area states.
That you can't even talk about these local operators in the space of gauging area states.
No, no, I want to... The commutator algebra, which is obviously satisfying microcausality, is indeed an algebra of gauge-dependent operators. However, the gauge invariant operators are a subset of those things.
What?
At least if we believe, there are some issues about whether the prescription that Daniel would give in terms of geodesics perhaps really defines something that is a truly gauge invariant BRST invariant operator to be reformulated in this gauge. But if I assume that it can.
There is a construction that can.
Well, Don, I think you do agree that, I mean, on the gauge invariant subspace of states, I mean, yeah, anything I do in the center is going to have to not commute with the Hamiltonian, right?
Yes.
So then I don't understand what you're saying.
It doesn't.
My thing doesn't. But I thought you were saying something else.
No, all I was saying is that you talk about this being a grungy calculation.
Yeah, you're saying there's another way of doing the calculation.
Which is a slick calculation. There may be a slick step that...
But it can't be too slick because it has to see that it doesn't commute on this line, right?
But it will. Yeah. It will. The point is that if you work in a covariant gauge, then you get microcausality for the gauge-dependent operators.
Yeah.
Then the trick would be to write your observable, which is gauge-invariant, as a gauge invariant combination of gauge dependent things.
Good, but that's hard for these, right? I mean, so of course I thought about that, right? So in electromagnetism, you can just draw the Wilson line and declare it gauge invariant. Yeah. But here, I mean, you have to deal with that.
It's actually not.
If I define it gauge invariantly, then it has to depend on the metric everywhere in a space time, because there's some background where the geometry was
but
not determined.
That's
right. So I mean, that's why I had to do perturbation theory.
Perturbation theory, there's an issue with these kinds of operators because they're non-polynomial functions of the local fields in perturbation theory. Mm-hmm. Every order of perturbation theory, they need a new definition to remove divergences. They are not well-defined order by order in perturbation theory. There's an infinite sequence of coefficients.
Uh-huh.
And, whether or not you can always choose those coefficients so that the things will continue to commute, and it's a non-convergent series, and whether that means anything about commutation,
you're saying true in electromagnetism too?
No, in electromagnetism, if you use Wilson lines, we know exactly what the renormalization consists of. There's an exponential of an infinite constant times the length of the Wilson line.
Even for non-abelian.
The thing that's analogous to this in ordinary gauge theory is to define the unitary gauge fields in a covariant gauge where the theory is renormalizable. And the unitary gauge fields don't exist order by order in perturbation theory because they're non-polynomial functions of the covariant gauge fields. And they need a new subtraction at each order in perturbation new subtractions.
So in Pfefferman ground gauge, these are polynomial. It's just the metric and the fields.
Doesn't involve inverses of the metric?
But the metric inverse in perturbation theory is polynomial, right? Because
that means that at each order, there's a new composite operator that you have to renormalize the Green's functions of.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So defining this thing involves an infinite number of subtractions. In each order of perturbation theory, it's a finite number. The number grows. Number in general involves all operators that have the same naive scaling dimension in the free theory that you're perturbing around, and the same set of quantum numbers.
You're just giving a problem if I want to talk about that field. But let's just talk about this field and this field. So this is as polynomial. I mean, I'm just looking at this in some particular coordinates in Pfefferman's ground gauge. That's what this operator is.
Right. But
so that can't be that. I mean,
Write a covariant expression for it.
No, that's a mess, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, no, if it's a mess, what does it mean it's a mess? Is it a polynomial mess?
No, it is not.
So then you have the problem that I just said.
If you try and do the calculation that way, but if you do it this way...
No, I'm just responding to what Don said.
I see.
Okay. I'm not objecting to the calculation, as you said you did.
But if you do things this way, don't you have to carry out, I mean, isn't the point that you have to carry out the renormalization in this gauge? The point is, I thought your point was that if you appeal to the expressions in this gauge, then you have to carry out this whole renormalization in this gauge.
Well,
you can't appeal to the one in covariant.
You certainly can appeal to the covariant gauge, obvious local commutivity, and so on and so forth.
I see what you mean. Okay.
Because the things are not defined.
Well, yeah, that was a comment about this point. So about the difference between the gauge theory and the gravity case. I think you can see that explicitly in the tensor network. That the gauge, there is some gauge symmetry there in the tensors, but it's fundamentally different from the gauge. From the gauge theory, because you have these tensors and the gauge symmetries are like doing some transformations on the left, which correspond to some transformations here. And the intrinsic difference from gauge field case is in the gauge field you're doing gauge transformations on these points, and that gauge environment quantity is made by vector potential, which is like 2-point quantity. It's something behind. Link between 2 points. And here, the gauge environment quantity is made by these kind of things, which are 4 points, which are, depending on the 4 points, each point can be transformed by a gauge environment. And that's the reason that if I want to write a gauge environment operator, I cannot just draw a loop. It has to be like specifying the gauge at every point.
In the gravity case.
So
that's one of the features captured by your models.
That's interesting.
So
then
you see that if you want to, what are the operators like somewhere here? If I write it back to the whole Hilbert space, it's not a local operator, but it's a local operator times projection on all other points. It's projecting all other tensors to a fixed value, which means you set the diagonal. So it seems like these kind of things can. I think they can be defined even if you are here. There is no. I don't see why the tensor network cannot define these slices. I will have one network describing that slice, and this is another slice which describes the same bit, and they are related by gauge transformation.
To be clear, so the operator I described does not have the form you said, because the two operators I drew on the board commute with each other.
Yeah.
Whereas the ones you wrote probably don't, because they have those projections on all the sites.
So probably I would want identity at Y and then project on other sites.
The projection is only on that line somehow or something, right? You see the.
I'm
not worried about non-perturbatively. I'm just talking about imperturbation theory. Those two operators commute to all orders in perturbation theory.
Yeah. So I think they are like this. Like, you still need the projection that's setting the diagram, but you can leave enough room for having both operators satisfying the boundary. This is identity in that point. And so you have. Something here and
the thing I said you can't have is an operator in the CFT that commutes with everything except at one point, but isn't a local operator at that point. That's the only claim I think.
Commutes with everything except at one point.
Yeah, but isn't a local operator at that point.
Mm-hmm. Dan, do you know what the renormalization properties in the Pfefferman-Gram gauge of this operator you've defined are? In other words, what you have to do, the all orders in perturbation theory, to make it a finite operator. I mean, and let's, you know, I'm giving you the fact that we can add counter terms to GR to the Lagrangian, and we're not going to worry about that.
Well, I mean, I didn't really do any calculations, but I think I guess what I would say is you smear them a little bit in the coordinates, and that's enough to make them finite in correlation functions.
That's not usually the case.
Well, finite, but finite, but I mean large, because the amount that I smear it over will replace the divergences. And then if you want to make things that are independent of the smearing, then indeed you have to do some operator renormalization. But if you're asking, what does that operator renormalization look like, I'm not sure I can say anything particularly precise.
In normal local field theory, we don't have to think about smearing. I take an operator phi of x, and I compute its Green's functions to all orders, doing whatever renormalization of the Lagrangian I have to do to get finite answers. And then I find one extra divergence that can be shown to all orders in perturbation theory corresponds to just multiplying the operator by a constant.
That's true.
And that's not true.
That's not true for composite operators.
And for composite operators, what's true is you have a whole set of operators of the same dimension and the same quantum numbers, and the renormalization constant becomes a matrix in that space.
Well, no, you can mix. I mean, you can mix with things with different dimension because you can have powers of the cutoff, right? So you can have, you know, in five times phi, you can have the identity. And which you subtract off if you're trying to get the low energy piece of phi squared.
Okay, sure.
Well, right. You're going to use Dimmrag.
Dimmrag is for phenomenologists. Yeah.
What? I mean, you can, in covariant gauges, you can do Dimmrag in quantum gravity, too. I mean, Tipton Belton did it.
Yeah, but it doesn't make any sense. You know that, right? I mean, it only makes sense because it's equivalent to things that make sense. I learned that from Atuf. That's what he told me. He says he doesn't teach it in his class because it's too confusing.
Okay.
No, definitely makes sense. If you those
doesn't make physical sense. Of course it makes mathematical sense.
No, if you keep those divergences, which are for sure there, and okay, discard the rest, which can be...
No, but it throws out physical things. It throws out, I mean, quadratic divergences are real physical effects. There are all sorts of wrong papers where people try and say that, you know, somehow they're not there because of Dimmrag.
They're there. But they're, if it's something sensitive, I mean, which is not described by your effective field theory, so that's something sensitive to completion.
I thought the usual rule was that power law divergences can depend on your normalization scheme. So if you have one where they're set to zero, that's fine. You can sort of throw them away and then unambiguous.
No, but that just means you have, okay, this shouldn't become a discussion. Let's
broaden the discussion both in subject and in people.
Without changing the topic completely, I just wanted to raise a question that, personally, I don't think anybody's going to have a good answer for, but it should be voiced, which is, what about the case with no boundary? So we're all talking like the bulk Hilbert space got to be equal to the CFT Hilbert space. It's just a matter of understanding exactly what that means. But don't we believe that that it makes sense to do quantum gravity in a space without boundary, or not? Maybe the answer is no, we don't believe that. But if we do believe that, then doesn't that mean that even if there is a boundary, there must be stuff that doesn't refer to the boundary inside the bulk? In which case, the bulk Hilbert space somehow would not be equivalent to the CFT, presumably. So I just wanted to voice the question. If you guys want to now move on, that's okay, but I'd be very happy to hear a reaction or a suggestion.
I mean, if we phrase everything in terms of the scattering matrix, why do we even talk about the bulk Hilbert space?
Well, what is the scattering matrix in the case that he's talking about?
No,
he's talking about De Sitter space.
Oh, okay. So no boundary.
I think De Sitter space is not really that much of an issue because of the fact that the causally connected region of De Sitter space, that does have a boundary. And if you're someone who thinks in this holographic way, the theory of De Sitter space would just be defined on that diamond.
You mean the horizon?
Yeah, the horizon, and there would be this issue of how do you have descriptions that are compatible between observers that have different horizons. But there would be a boundary. Other kinds of no boundary cosmologies may or may not exist. I don't know how to define. I mean, what we've learned from string theory and ADS-CFT is that we know how to define theories of quantum gravity for spaces that have these asymptotic boundaries. I would claim that for de Sitter space with large enough radius, I think there's a sensible proposal that effectively puts in a boundary. But for generic, you know, like a collapsing cosmology that expands and recollapses, I'm not sure we'll ever have a sensible quantum theory. I think it's a question. I don't agree
that the de Sitter space has a good boundary, because, I mean, when we look in ADS, we can work from the boundary because it's an asymptotic region that we can keep fixed and where we have very good control of what the geometry is. And if you go, I mean, the de Sitter space has a horizon. Mm-hmm. And then, so if I would declare the horizon to be my boundary, I mean, that would be like working on the horizon of a black hole, and we know that that's not a very good place to sit and put your theory. I mean, it's simply not a, even in ADS, we know that when you start putting, try to put something on the horizon of the ADS black hole, we lose control of what is going on. So
I think there is a good analogy, and that you're absolutely right that if you just think about a generic state of the theory, then de Sitter space doesn't have interesting physics. But the way you make interesting physics is by poking holes in it. The same way that, in a way that I think you and I are close to agreement on, you understand what's going on inside a black hole by poking holes in it.
Yeah, this I understand.
Okay. So.
But then I'm not sure that the holographic perspective is the one that is the right one, because then you're working in a Hilbert space which is very large. Which, I mean, in ADS space we can do things well because we are close to the ground state. So we know that at infinity we have space time into the ground state.
Right.
Well, if you're inside a black hole, you know you have all these other states right. around, and you're doing it in the middle of
space. We know the ground state has a huge entropy, and so it's similar. And in our theory of asymptotically flat space, also has a huge Hilbert space of degrees of freedom that you don't see in the S matrix, but which decouple.
Tom, can you elaborate on the word ground state has a large entropy?
Yeah, empty de Sitter space has a large entropy.
Well, that's
the
Hilbert
state is a ground state.
And if you,
yeah.
Excuse me, okay. There is a vacuum, quote, configuration, empty de Sitter space, that has a large entropy. And the most interesting thing about this statement is if you put a local excitation in it, you decrease the entropy.
Yes, I agree. That's very confusing. Yeah.
It's not confusing, it's the clue to the whole story.
Okay, yes. I think then it's wrong to call de Sitter space a ground state.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. Is it the ground state of a Hamiltonian?
It's not an excited state.
Yes, of course.
Sorry, what is this entropy? This is not an entanglement entropy between two regions.
Sorry?
It's
not entanglement.
It's a configuration.
Well, unless you put it, there's another side of the de Sitter space.
Yeah, yeah.
You can think of it as entanglement with another side.
Yeah.
But I agree, it's not even a useful thing. It's like a thermal double compared to the
single side. I'm curious actually what people think about this. Tom said this is an essential point. I think he's right, so let me just say it again, and I'm curious to hear what people think about it. So de Sitter space has this amusing property that if you fix the cosmological constant and then you put in a black hole of mass M in the center, then the entropy decreases. And now if you compute dsve, where you define E to be this mass, then you get minus 1 over the given Hawking temperature. So how do we think about that minus? I guess we can say we borrow that from a stretched horizon.
What Tom is saying is that you specify the state from the generic state to a more specified state, and this brings down the entropy. But even in Ted's recent paper, he shows that if you put something in that the entanglement entropy causes an area deficit, things go down when you put mass into you're specifying more of the degrees of freedom when you put a localized matter configuration in the book. So this is something that matter does. It somehow binds some of the whatever you can excite to make the entanglement entropy, and it makes it less.
It actually, there's a specific interpretation of it in my paper. I'm not positive it's right, but it's actually a statement of that we're starting with a vacuum and then we're putting this extra thing in. But if the vacuum is in equilibrium state, it should have maximal entropy. So if I put in some energy, then actually corresponds to an addition of sort of entanglement entropy by the variation formula, by the first law of entanglement entropy. But I can't increase the entropy because I was already at maximum entropy. So the horizon has to get smaller so that the area contributions of the entropy offsets the increase of the extra stuff I put in. Essentially, in this recent paper I wrote, it's the statement that you're at a stationary point, namely the maximum of the local entropy. Now, whether that's really physically right, I don't know, but that's the way it works in that calculation.
Well, I think there's, I'm not sure that you're getting something that, to Willie and myself, is extremely important. So one of the things about that formula for the black hole mass in De Sitter space, the black hole entropy in De Sitter space, is that if you take the mass much smaller than the maximal mass you can have in De Sitter space, so the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole is much smaller than the radius of De Sitter space, then you can ask, what's the entropy deficit? Okay, and this is the minus sign.
Right.
Okay. And the entropy deficit is E over KT De Sitter.
Right.
Okay. And I'll leave out the K because
God. Yeah, seriously.
E over T De Sitter. Okay. When I talk to condensed matter.
Why? I don't want to use book yet.
Okay. So this is a derivation from that formula of the fact that ordinary matter in De Sitter space has a temperature T De Sitter, even though the, you'll excuse me for calling it the ground state density matrix is, in my interpretation, the maximal entropy density matrix that's possible given the Hilbert space that corresponds to the theory. So the degrees of freedom on the horizon have infinite temperature, okay? And the density matrix is completely random, but the energetic things, the localized things, have a temperature because they're constrained states, because of the fact that putting them in decreases the entropy. And that formula gets the right temperature.
So, Tom, just to be clear, when you talk about the entropy deficit, you're adding the black hole entropy to the horizon entropy?
No.
Well, it's a very
I take the black hole space-time.
Yeah.
I count up the area of the two horizons.
Yeah. Okay. You add them together.
I add them together.
And then you compare
them. I compare that
to empty De Sitter space.
And it's less.
And it's less, and this is the difference when the black hole gas is small.
So you are.
That's what I got.
The black hole entropy is very tiny compared to the change of the horizon.
Yeah, okay. So then the other really important point is that this entropy deficit is much, much bigger than any entropy you could attribute to the black hole itself. Mm-hmm. And it's if there are n squared degrees of freedom for the black hole, you've set of order n of them to zero. Okay? And this is this story that we tell about how making an energetic thing corresponds to poking holes in the set of degrees of freedom that are sort of naturally there in the vacuum. And that works in Minkowski space as well, if you give those degrees of freedom on the boundary an appropriate dynamics such that they decouple in the limit of infinite causal diamond. And then in De Sitter space, where they don't decouple, because you don't take the causal diamond to infinity, they have an effect, and they give rise to the De Sitter temperature.
Sorry for asking a naive question, but when I take the flat space limit, does this go to zero or?
Goes to infinity,
which is...
Yeah. So what happens is that there's an infinite set of degrees of freedom, which you don't see as local field theory degrees of freedom, but the Hamiltonian is set up so that they decouple from the local degrees of freedom in the limit that the causal diamond type goes to infinity, so you throw them away.
So that corresponds back to the Minkowski space, you have a zero probability being a non-zero energy state.
Right.
And zero probability being a non, yeah.
So these states all have, in our Hamiltonian formulation, they have zero energy in the limit of infinite causal diamond. Their contribution to the Hamiltonian goes like 1 over the radius of the causal diamond.
So that means if I'm in a nearly flat space, then I create a black hole, then there is actually a big deficit, but I just don't see it.
That's right.
So can the relativists maybe comment on this energy of the static patch in the sitter space? I mean, is that a thing?
You mean, is it well defined?
Yeah, or is there some way in trying to define it?
There's an A in generalization.
What? This T is sort of the temperature defined with respect to the static patch Hamiltonian.
Right.
Well, there's a killing energy if you're perturbing around the space-time with symmetry, but there's no analog of the ADM energy,
right,
unless you mean the entropy of the sitter itself.
That's my confusion. So
it's a bit like getting the energy of a closed universe,
which I thought was zero. So
on the board?
There are people that define energy of the sitter, but they take like flat slices.
They both refer to the killing vector of the symmetric background you're perturbing.
But this is a very perturbative statement, right?
Right.
Yeah. Is it ambiguous at higher orders than perturbative? I mean, if there's, you know, sizable back reaction.
You can
linearized approximation, you can define that.
Yeah, I agree.
Linearized fields in the center, you have a killing energy. Right.
But I mean, you know, I could have planets flying around, big black holes, you know, all kinds of stuff.
What I did in my recent paper is take the limit of very small little mini to sitter spaces so that even if you have curvature and planets flying around, you just go inside the planet in between two atoms, and you know, and then you still apply a formula like that, and it still corresponds to the Einstein equation and still corresponds to equilibrium. So if you have a separation of scales like that, the basic idea still applies, I think.
And well, if I put in a planet, does that energy go up or down?
If the state inside my little tiny diamond is not the vacuum, it goes up. Actually, I have to actually allow for comparing to a maximally symmetric little diamond. So there could be a zero point of energy that has to be floating until I put together all the diamonds, and then the Bianchi identity tells me fixes that floating point up to an overall constant.
Is there some sense in which I can say that the total Hamiltonian is zero, we know that, and then I want to interpret it as sort of H horizon minus H, stuff, and then that's where this minus sign comes from, because really when I put energy in the center, I'm borrowing it from the horizon, and then so then that's where...
Well, there's a sense in, well, you can think of H equals zero as being...
I guess if you complete it to the other side, you kind of want to say that, right?
Yeah, you can think of the H on the left and the H on the right.
Yeah, but I don't know if a relativist would be happy with that, with the left and right. And
I know of a relativist, excluding present company, who has been happy with that, I think.
Well, I don't know. I don't understand.
Okay. So the whole point of this is that the energy is likely just the coarse-grained way of looking at it, and it's really due to these entropic differences, which turns out there's some good arguments this is actually equivalent to the induced gravity scenario, where your entire gravitational action, which you think is whatever gravitates, so that's energy, is really just induced by quantum correction. There's some RG-flow arguments that suggest this is equivalent to this idea that everything is about entropy.
So coming back to the case, by the way, that people think they understand the best, okay? I'd like to raise at least this question of, what is the collective wisdom of, our sense of what we can really do, and what is the answer? Is it just HKLL? Is it some imagined improvement on HKLL? There's also the question of the trying to get the S matrix. What do people think is the status in the case that we claim to understand the best? So, some,
So these are for states near the vacuum, you know, basically.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be true for arbitrary states that you reduce to local quantum field theory stuff, as we've already discussed. So, say states of AES that are near vacuum states, sure. Here's some nice properties. HKLL, and we're done.
For back, I mean, for ADS or for you know, perturbations, fields in ADS, I think there's no problem. You can get local operators in terms of the. You have all the modes problem. Described by you know states.
Well, there are questions of order by order and having a controlled approximation. In some sense, and I think this was something Hermann was driving at, you're using the background.
Sure.
There are at least two things I could underline there.
But that's supposed to be the ground state. I mean, we start off saying, okay, the ground state of your field theory is ADS. We just accept that.
Yeah.
And now you can use the ADS geometry to...
isomorphies,
we've got asymmetries in the boundary. Your points around. So the ground state, it's pretty clear how you can do things. And
there's no obstruction.
So the claim is that at finite but small g, we're done. We just have to be more careful about it.
Well, I think there's something more precise. I would define ADS CFT being true as at least implying the following statement. If you look at correlation functions of local boundary operators of low dimension, single trace, that there is some effective bulk Lagrangian which reproduces those correlation functions order by order in N.
So this is something that that should come out in the end.
Sure, but if that's true, then all the rest of this stuff is sort of automatic.
You could
just
do
focus
that as
the
goal
on that. If you want to fight about this, we should just fight about that question.
But except for the fact that the HKLL construction pretends to be constructing operators in a local space. Whereas you talk about some restricted set of correlation functions that are going to be calculated.
Well, right, but we just had a whole discussion about how HKLL is really a statement about operators on a subspace of states, and it's a subspace I can construct by looking at these operators I described.
Okay, good. So what you're saying is there's nothing in HKLL that goes beyond Feynman-Witten's R.
No, that's the point.
Yeah.
Okay. As long as these boundary correlators are given by Feynman-Witten diagrams, we're done.
Right. I agree with that.
Okay.
You raised some issues earlier, Tom.
Not with the idea that boundary correlators are given by Feynman-Witten diagrams.
But there's a question of getting back to the operator.
No, but what Daniel is saying, and this is something I always agreed with him about, or with anybody who said this, is that it's clear from if that construction works, then we know, kind of following on ideas of Weinberg from the 1960s, we know how to construct a local Lagrangian that will give rise to all of those calculations.
I learned this from Tom's paper, I should say.
The way we get field theory out of perturbative string theory in Minkowski space.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of amplitudes. Some of those amplitudes we know how to calculate by doing field theory Feynman diagrams, and we know, how to define the restrictions on those amplitudes so that that's all.
So let's back up. So you're saying not that we should provide a map between the two Hilbert spaces directly, or between the operators that act on the Hilbert spaces. We should use the boundary theory to infer a Lagrangian, and then we should just construct what we call the bulk Hilbert space.
Well, the logic is maybe cleanest that way. I'd like to just discuss the bulk algebra.
Shouldn't there be a map?
There's a subspace of states, and we can talk about the algebra of observables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so there should be a map.
But it's that way of thinking, I think, follows from the statement I said.
So the wisdom of everyone here is that HKLL is solving problem.
If ADS-CFT is true, in the sense they said.
Well, no, we need to check that.
So I think on general backgrounds, I think it's a little more tricky.
Yeah.
ridiculous. I mean, in pure ADS, I'm totally happy with it.
Yeah.
Also because, but on another background, I mean, I find it tricky, and especially if you want to use it to go beyond beyond the horizon, this is sort of where it was sometimes used, and then you already see that there's an issue.
Absolutely.
And
there it's surely not enough.
Already, I mean, yeah. It just started at horizon, now it starts earlier.
Wasn't there already an issue if you just approach the horizon? That's the Riddler horizon in ADS space. If I want to go really, really close, even if I say my GS is string coupling is small, if I go really, really, really close to the boundary, eventually I'm still going to be probing the string uniform gravity physics. So
if you dare,
where most of the information.
If you hang from a string, you mean.
Yeah.
Well, but this would imply doing conformal mappings on the boundary, which are very singular, because you sort of have to go to corner frame where you are indeed creating this horizon, and that becomes a quantum gravity curve.
Right. I'm just saying we're missing almost all the degrees of freedom that way. So I mean, in some sense, it's a huge.
Oh, yeah. That has to do also with the question, actually, maybe it's something we have discussed already, is but whether it makes sense to split the Hilbert space into two regions, so because that's the kind of thing you're doing with sort of singular conformal mappings. And then you go outside of your perturbative picture of ADS space.
Okay. Well, we can leave that for now unless others have further comments. What about some of the other themes, topics? Where, again, you know, where should we be going? What are fruitful avenues? Or what should we cross? Is there something we should cross off the board? This is a question that was raised. Or things we should not
be doing. Well, the workshop was supposed to be quantum gravity UV to IR. So did any of the IR stuff end up being relevant to UV stuff?
One of our deepest problems is, in some sense, an IR problem, the information problem. So there was a lot of discussion of that in that sense, and there are other IR issues that certainly entered in various ways to the discussion, you know, how to think about the scattering states, even how to, in Tom's way of thinking, you know, formulate the dynamics of the theory involves that.
These precursors, I think, eventually also become very complicated objects that must involve IR part of the physics.
Well, the standard thing everybody says about that is that it just involves these very high dimension operators and so on and so forth.
Well, I think it has many soft things around it as well, because those precursors are not very clear.
What they are,
and they may involve a lot of low energy stuff.
So just many low energy too.
That might actually be another way of thinking about them. And actually, I think it's even more likely it's made in that way than by some very sharp, whatever high energy mode. It may be a very complicated state made up of many, many low energy modes, and certainly in the story that explains it.
It's
even more likely way of thinking.
Very IR, non-local, but extremely small amplitude excitation, sort of the very high energy So
I think I would like to connect it to.
We're doing quantum mechanics, right? You can't have an arbitrarily small amplitude excitation of a mode.
Well, you can have it. It won't be an orthogonal state in that one mode. But we have so many degrees of freedom, and they're all involved all at once. And a little amplitude. I don't know what it adds up to.
He means the quantum amplitude, not the amplitude of the wave. Right.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I see. I'm sorry.
Yeah. For Daniel, so if you take your error correcting code and I take this space, it's a ground state of ADS. I use one of your dangling qubits. I put a qubit in there, and then that information is shared by all the states. Why would it be even a local thing? It's something that has an enormous width, and I can simply spread it over the entire.
It's very non-local on the boundary.
It's very non-local on the boundary. It's very light, but even in the bulk, I might even see it. Because
but in the bulk, these guys all commute with each other. That's the interesting.
I use all of them. Let's use all of your dangling qubits.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make one bit hiding So I'm going to make a new qubit code out of those bits, where I make one qubit simply shared by all of them.
You can do that. I mean, so.
And then this is a very IR mode,
yeah.
And it's using a highly entangled state. And I would say those kind of states don't have always obvious interpretations in terms of the low energy physics. They're really complicated things that, from the boundary, might involve.
Well, this is like some state of the gas of gravitons, right? It's like, you know, the gravitons are all over the place entangled with each other and some, you know, some.
Because.
That's how I would think
about it. So, Daniel, but your construction doesn't have any place in it this large gap in the spectrum that we think is necessary to have an
right.
approximate local, yet you have something that's very local.
I'll make two comments about that. So by my construction, do you mean the tensor network or the more general? The tensor network doesn't have sub-ADS locality, so that gap is less important.
No, you can add in the locality in the way I talked about, but I think that corresponds to a case where the gap is infinite, right? Because there is having an uniform mirror that you get that.
Yeah, I still don't know how to interpret it. Maybe.
If you have an uniform mirror that you use that, then it's infinite. I mean, I understand it's not always exact or both or like two intervals, but in the case, if most of them are.
So your thing would correspond to the gap to the higher dimension operators
being taken to be infinite. Because the mutual information of two intervals is exactly zero for most of the cases, which means there is no correction.
Yeah, I mean, somehow.
But you can modify the tensors a little bit and catch that down.
Well, there should be at least the stress tensor, right? So that you always have that. So, so I mean, yeah, I think.
Oh, you don't have the stress tensor?
No, neither do I, embarrassingly.
Okay, so if it's exactly zero, then you lock all the low light
modes. I mean, I have exact space like commutativity in the book. That's bad.
That's bad.
Yeah. And not in the more general picture, but in the model.
Other points people want to raise? Is there a firewall or isn't? I guess we.
It's a little late to bring that up.
No, it's dawn left. Other comments, thoughts? Especially from those of you who have not spoken up?
I think super selection sectors should be mentioned, although I have nothing to say about them, but I think it's an important issue.
Well, Ted sort of raised it. That's the idea of closed universes might have observables, degrees of freedom, which are not registered on the boundary.
Yeah, that drives at this, you know. That would say there's a coarse graining. You don't have equality here.
Yeah, that says ADS is not equal to the CFT.
Some form of coarse graining. Well, or it's only approximately true in a coarse grained sense.
Yeah, so Don and I suggested that the bulk is described by the CFT times another tensor factor, which only matters for stuff behind the horizon.
Well, or it could be some more complicated story, I imagine.
Yeah, there's actually some difficulties in making a more complicated story. For example, sometimes people want to say, well, maybe these degrees of freedom are only there when there's a black hole. So if you have a black hole, there's lots of other degrees of freedom, but if you have the ADS vacuum, there isn't. But this actually runs into trouble with the CFT, because there ought to be raising operators and lowering operators that take you from no black hole to black hole. And just the structure of quantum mechanics is such that if you try to mess with the degeneracy of states, you'll no longer have well-defined. If the black hole has too many states, then I could raise it to the black hole. But then if I have one of these other black hole states that wasn't obtained that way, and I try to lower it back down to the ADS vacuum, something weird would have to happen.
There are other kinds of coarse graining, though, like the kinds we're familiar with from the point of view of, say, renormalization group or whatever, where we integrate out short distance degrees of freedom. And I guess, well, I'm not sure if those are, you know, literally thinking of things in terms of tensor factors, or it's a little more complicated.
No, what happens there is that you assume that the high energy degrees of freedom are in a particular state, their ground state. If you don't do that,
then you can
the RG doesn't work the same way. You have to add in extra things.
And in some sense, which the whole way ADS-CFT works is because, in some sense, when you have the very high energy degrees of freedom, in some sense, you have everything because it's by locality. The long range stuff is just made out of the short range stuff and field theory in some entangled way. That's just the standard story in ADS for why the boundary should be able to encode stuff by the rings of the pole. It's not clear, it gets us into the horizon.
Other comments or thoughts? We really touched on everything.
Well, one question I want to raise, simple question. Well, so if we believe that in AGS, CFT is exactly dual to Gravity, do we believe the same will hold for flat space time, where we have a matrix on one side and perturbative gravity on the other side? Or there will be less information in the S matrix and in CFT. So, it's kind of there's a step on the way to the theater, right? Where it's more complicated. So, halfway kind of.
Oh, I don't know.
So, what do we think about it? That do we expect S matrix to carry all the information we want to? We can possibly get about gravity or not.
There might be a dual description of quantum gravity in flats and asymptotically flat spaces, which consists of more than the S matrix.
Yeah.
Does BFSS have more than the S matrix, Tom?
No.
Yeah, what would that
but be? It seems that there could be, again, some construction, some notion of, diff invariant observables or gauge invariant observables that are relational, that they're useful in certain states. Again, they do bad things in bad states, but they might do good things in good states and effectively reduce to, say, local operators. So that's at least one suggestion, and of course the question is how to realize that in detail.
One other thing that certainly exists in string theory, which is not complete localization, and it's certainly not localization in the bulk, is you can define amplitudes for D-brains, okay? And those, we believe, exist to the same degree that we believe anything else exists. Now, for the D0 brains, that's just another sector of the S-matrix. So the amplitudes that you define seem like they depend on, a D0 brain position someplace in space. But if you look at, what's actually gauge invariant there for D0 brains, the only thing that's actually going to make sense is the scattering amplitude. Mm-hmm. For higher dimensional brains, if the brain goes off to infinity, you can anchor it at infinity in some way, and then you define scattering amplitudes off the brain that have less symmetry and include the possibility of exciting the brain and sending things off that never get back out as particles, but just are excitations on the brain. So there are generalizations of the S matrix in string theory. I tend to think of those as sort of, the way we think of it. In ADS-CFT, you can perturb ADS space by adding a relevant operator to the conformal field theory, and then you get another spacetime which doesn't have the symmetries of ADS and sort of has something sitting somewhere in ADS. And I'm not saying that thing is a D-brain, but that it's an analog of what the way I think about the D-brain theories. Its dynamics is completely determined by the dynamics of the CFT, because you can calculate everything by calculating CFT correlators in perturbation theory, but and similarly, we can calculate all of these D-brain S matrices from the rules that we know in perturbative string theory, with the slight modifications that Joe Polchinski taught us. So there are other observables in that sense, but they all have this S matrix character. They're all somehow anchored off at infinity in asymptotically broad space.
Yeah, also they seem to be in a different super selection set, yeah, because if I start from no deep brain,
yeah, you can't make a state with an infinite deep brain. Yeah. You can create pairs of D0 brains.
Yeah.
But that will just be another sector of the S matrix that you missed in perturbation theory. They're like soliton.
It doesn't, when you think, like if you just look at the CFT and the usual ideal CFT and compare that to what you imagine being the in and out states in the S matrix in asymptotically flat space, there's just so much more in the CFT, and N is very large, and you know, it just seems like the asymptotic form of the gravitational degrees of freedom is just nowhere near enough. Presumably, you have to have, like, most of the Hilbert space would be these extra sectors.
Well, and I also say it's also too much in another sense, because when we have to be careful what would be the appropriate analog of ADS-CFT in flat space. People say the S matrix, but I don't think that's right. Because if you know your theory, even in a flat, even in quantum field theory with no gravity, it's possible to work out your state if you know the state at scry minus or scry plus. The really surprising thing about ADS-CFT is not that you can work out your state from the boundary, which is a codimension one surface. The surprising thing is that you can work out your state essentially from a slice of the boundary, which is a codimension two surface. So people often use holography in the sloppy ways to refer to codimension one surfaces, but should really be codimension two surfaces, including in flat space time. So I would think a flat space time holography is if you can somehow reconstruct everything that's going to come out to null infinity if you know everything that's true at space-like infinity,
that's right.
Which is codimension two in some sense.
Yeah, by the way, if you know, since apparently you know most people feel the answer, or at least those who are willing to speak up feel the answer to this is affirmative, that the HKLL takes care of it, then you know, you just work at pretty large R and you know, small GS, and you can basically construct local bulk observables more or less, and you're done. So
well, the limit is 3 here for now.
Well, part of it, well. If you buy everything that was just equal, well, if you think that this is answered in the affirmative by HKLL, I think you're done.
Well, it's not as strong as that, because at least in the way that Daniel and I were just talking about, you can only use those observables to calculate asymptotic quantities. You don't know what else you can do with them.
Oh, no. Well, they're supposed to match on
both of
the
propagators.
Yeah, that's what the claim is. That you can literally get field operators on the.
Yeah, you get the they're gauge invariant bulk operators that are defined order by order in perturbation theory, and you can get those from the one over n expansion in the CFT. You can compute their expectation values.
But we think that in principle is enough, at least I think, that. It's in principle enough to know all the boundary correlation functions.
Yeah, that was the point.
Well, that's
that was what I was arguing.
Well, about only
HKLL, when you plug in the formula, you're in the end, you're always just computing some boundary correlation functions and then integrating them against some.
Okay. Yeah, and that's what I meant by phrasing it this way. Starting with, say, some correlators, can you, write down the formula that, say, gives you correlators of bulk effective field operators? Well, we're almost just about out of time.
Is there this tour or something?
Yeah, if people are interested, probably this is a good time to try.
We could go look at the insides of atoms.
So this Alice
supernova.
It started at 12, but I was told if we go now, we could still see it.
Okay.
It's kind of a spherical projection room where you stand inside the sphere, and it's been used for various data visualization projects. I don't know how well developed it is, but that's the story. And I think I know where it is, so how about if we meet by the door of the lobby next to the main seminar room at 12:30 exactly.
Okay. That how far away is
it? Right across the street.
Just across the
right, right across
the street. Oh, it's just the next building.
Yeah. I'd like to thank Steve for everything he's done for organizing.